Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, and welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here on Pub Day for Food Gift Love, this amazing book of edible gifts by Maggie Batista, better known as Eat Boutique. This community that you've cultivated, both online and in person, of, you know, craft makers and artisan, you know, food items. It's just kind of an amazing, it's not a niche anymore because it's so much bigger than that.
It's funny. It's funny how it sort of came to life over, I guess, 8 years now. But it's a really interesting community of food makers and chefs, but also food fans, aficionados. And we talk online, but we also meet in real life at the events we put on. So it's really sort of a great camaraderie that we've built over the last several years.
Passion for interaction with you know, a humanistic side to it came from your mother, who was a very compassionate person and, you know, led these food drives and community pantries.
Very funny and very strange. And, well, she did a wonderful thing, but I sort of became the opposite of that. I went into technology.
Yeah.
And I focused on being behind a computer for 15 years, building online communities. But yeah, my mother sort of was in my head the whole time I was writing the book and reminded me of all the stuff that she did and we did as kids. She would drag me to everybody's house when she dropped off all the food. So I guess that stuff sort of sticks with you.
Yeah.
In some strange way.
I mean, was there a specific packaging or was it just a whole bunch of cans in a sack? And
it really was food drive style. So she really did have lists of people in the community that she and a bunch of other women collected food for. And every week, there are certain days of the week, we'd go. And she always took myself or my sister along. And it was sort of different than what I'd experienced or what I thought it would be. She actually, like, went inside people's homes, sat down with them, gave them the food. If they were making coffee, she was going to take coffee. She wasn't sort of, like, rushing to drop and leave. And as a kid, it was sort of strange to me. I thought, we should leave folks alone. You know, how can we be imposing on people in this manner? But it rung true. And she sort of unknowingly just built this thing inside me that wanted to do it, wanted to do that too, unknowingly, because I went immediately into technology when I graduated and started building online communities.
Yeah. But I mean, again, that important word community, and it's that conversation that happens around everything that's sold on Eat Boutique, you know, also the word curated, because that's what these boxes that you used to sell really are. But they have such stories behind them. And was it because your love of food or your love of food people, food fans, that you wanted to start Eat Boutique?
I think it was the people. I mean, I love food, but I remember going into places and just having a nice dinner someplace and a chef coming out and the kindness of their heart giving me a little jar of salt they infused with spices or herbs. And I think for me, the reason I started curating these gifts is because I thought these people needed to be shared with the world in some way. So it was about the people and then the food. Of course, it's always about the food, the delicious, unctuous, beautiful food, and how they're packaged and how we deliver it. But it, you know, the core of it is all these great makers and artists and visionaries who do things maybe a little bit differently.
Well, let's talk about New England, because it seems like you culled a great community of you know, artisans there from, you know, Lark Fine Foods and their cookies. Dee Dee Davis, her rose sugar from Salt Traders in Ipswich, Mass. How did you initially meet these people, interact with these people, and kind of conspire to disseminate?
It was very strange. I started a blog. I started a blog called Eat Boutique simply because I wanted to write about food and write my way into a life in food, and I didn't know what that meant exactly. But once I had put up a few posts and put up a few pictures, I actually reached out to Marianne at Lark. So Marianne and I have known each other since she started her cookie business, 7 years ago. I was one of the first people that she sold to. And I reached out to her and said, hey, you know, I love food, you love food, we're 10 minutes away from each other, can we get to know each other? And I think as a small business owner, you sometimes feel so alone when you're doing, you know, when you're getting off the ground. So just being able to kind of talk to someone who had interest in what you were doing, we got together, we met, we talked. I put her in one of our first gift collections that we ever did.
It's so wonderfully optimistic that you say that we talked, and I would have said, and we commiserated.
Well,
you know,
yes, it's hard.
way to put it in that positive light.
It definitely is.
But
hard.
Like you said, it is kind of an autonomous thing when you're starting a small business. You just feel so lost in the universe of things that are going on.
And you think that there's some magic going on somewhere else, like people know everything somewhere and you just don't know the magic or don't know the rule book, right? But really, like, we're all learning it as we go along. And I think when you start to get together and commiserate or chit-chat or have a glass of wine, you learn that kind of we're all in this together.
Big Picture Farms, the goat milk caramels. I think the first time I ever saw them, because my mother's lactose intolerant, was through Eat Boutique. I'm like, oh, that's a, you know, great item. And then I started browsing through Eat Boutique, and I'm like, yeah, I like that too. I'm going to check that off. I've never heard of that. And you become so invested, and it's one of those wonderful wormholes that you find. And, you know,
thank you.
Yeah,
that's
and,
sweet.
But it's that investment of time that you've put in to build these relationships too. Who have you gone out, like, sought after and really brought in?
Gosh, I'll say everybody's been really wonderful to work with. Big Picture Farm was one of them that we sort of, I forget how I tasted their stuff, but I just did. And I invited them to a market, and they came, and we had such a great time. I'm trying to think of some other makers that I worked with and sort of we grew together. Well, Lark, Dee Dee Davis, Ben at Jacobson's, mm-hmm. which is out on the West Coast, which we all know that amazing sea salt. I just saw Jamie Curl at Quinn out in Portland, Oregon. I just got back from Portland. And we have been friendly online for years. And I've watched her grow and watched her business changed. And we just finally met for the first time face-to-face, like last week. So it's really all different sorts of folks that I've worked with across the spectrum, sweet and savory and drinks. Drinks have actually been some of our most popular products. So I actually started with Kari Morris at Morris Kitchen. I was one of her first resellers. Oh gosh, Kari, if that was 5 years ago or something. And really just cultivated that friendship. And I think we finally did meet face to face last year, but everything online, stories online, photos online. So,
yeah. The word resale. I don't know if it has a kind of connotation to it, which good or bad, but, you know, seem to not take out the charm of something, but seem to be almost this larder, this place where, you know, there was stock, but there wasn't that person behind it, that initial artisan. But I think what you've invigorated in that resale space is you're such a champion of these people as well.
I'm passionate about these folks. That may sound crazy, but you know, I really focus on bringing together a collection of things that I love. And we go through a process of culling the folks we want to work with each year. And I think this year we've launched 20, 25, 30 different collections. And we work with those makers directly and, you know, figure out what's the best collection, what's sort of emblematic of their brand and what the story that they want to tell. So it's always been that way. I never sort of set out to say, I want to develop this gigantic website with 2 million products on it and sell. And, you know, that's, I could go work for someone else and do that sort of stuff. You know, I thought it was more important to get to know folks and really sort of bring food fans and food makers together.
And, you know, I want to talk a little bit more about that vetting process, because I know you had the terrible job of being in Paris and having to eat at all these bakeries and baguettes and croissants. But how do you figure out what you like and what you think other people will like best?
It is an arduous process. We do taste every week. So we get samples and samples of food gifts every single week. And we bring our tasting committee together. And we taste for different things. Certainly, first and foremost, we look at packaging. And we look if the vision is clear, if the ingredients are forthright. We try to understand how people, what ingredients people use versus others, why they chose this over that, especially with candy and some of the other things. People want to know more about. And then we taste and we take rigorous tasting notes. So it's sort of, it feels a little bit like tasting wine or tasting coffee. I've done all those sort of cupping sessions and tasting sessions, taking notes, referring back to things, trying to compare different chocolates at a time. I think I've tasted maybe 30 or 40 different kinds of marshmallows for texture, consistency, flavor, ingredients, packaging. But we literally go through that process. We sort of score all of our thoughts and we file it away for either the immediate season or for the future.
Yeah.
For something else.
I mean, talking about those collections you mentioned mm-hmm. before, what are this season's collections?
So this year we have about 25 different collections up online. And they sort of are across the spectrum from some of our favorite jams. So we work with Blue Chair Fruit, and we have a nice collection up of some of our favorite flavors. Rare Bird Preserves, we love Elizabeth, and she put together a great collection of both jams, but also curds, because passion fruit curd tends to be our most popular product. Come to an event, and the passion fruit curd is the first thing to disappear. We work with certainly chocolate makers, so we have a Farmhouse Truffles collection up, and we also have been working with some other sorts of makers. So Kate Bakes down in D.C., we put together a vegan bar collection, because I've been tasting lots and lots of vegan protein bars, granola bars of different kinds, because I think we all really want we want to give the sweet stuff, but there's just this sort of flood of wanting to give things that are wholesome and nourishing too, and healthful, full of health. So we have a great collection. One of our most popular collections is her bar collection of vegan bars. So it is a little bit across the spectrum of gifts.
I'm hopefully not going to make you cry, but what was it, 2013, when you met Alice Waters, accepting the AICP award, and you felt like it was a real business. Having this book out today, does it feel even more than that now?
I think it feels more, I don't know how to explain it. I'm an internet girl. You know, I grew up on the internet. I write a few words and chat with people or write a blog post and put it up in 30 seconds. So to have worked 2.5 years on a book, and then to finally have it out there, and then to get feedback today, this feels real. Like, this feels more real than most things. I can't explain it. Like, my friends have been reaching out today, cookbook authors. They've been reaching out all day just saying, you know, take it in. Yes, today is the day it feels real. And I know that's strange, but it may feel different tomorrow. I don't know. But today, it's really fun and exciting to get it out there.
Well, a huge congrats. And we're going to come back and talk about you, because you make stuff too.
I do.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back.
In
In 1996, L Knife & Son acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn, but has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Union Beer has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Kings County, Brooklyn, through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education on all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the 14 counties of southeastern New York. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
Hey, and welcome back to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here again today with Maggie Batista of Eat Boutique and the not just newly, but like just hot off the presses release, Food Gift Love, which is a wonderful book that's taken your background at Eat Boutique, you know, and it's taken it past other people's packaging. And it's not repackaging, it's rethought, it's homemade, it's deeply passionate and real.
It is. You know, I have some interesting people in my community at Eat Boutique, and some people want to shop, and I just love that. They should go off and shop. But there's a lot of folks who just want to make food gifts. And so I call together a lot of recipes. I think there's about 105 in the book from across the spectrum of categories, from things that I've been making for years, things that I've sort of honed and perfected. And I also had a big group of recipe testers who helped me through the process. That was actually a whole new community of folks, 80 recipe testers across the US, Canada, and Europe, who helped me, you know, who tasted the recipes, who gave me critical feedback, constructive support. They were awesome. So they are my recipes.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm psyched.
Well, I mean, having Eat Boutique too, you must have seen, like you said, the passion fruit card flies at events. What genres of things people were most interested in?
And it's, you know, it's almost always baked items. So yeah. There's no question that things that are sweet and delicious just fly. So that's cookies and cakes and pies and curds. And I have recipes for my versions of those throughout the cookbook. But cocktails fly too. And so do things that are more shelf stable. We know that jams and marmalades and pickles do, but what about salts and herbs and vinegars and things that you can keep in your pantry and just sort of dose out whenever the occasion arises? So the book is across the spectrum. I also include some potluck gifts in there because I feel like people always say to me, I'm not crafty. I don't know what a food gift is. And I say to them, have you been to a potluck? Did you bring a dish? There you go. You're a food gifter. You're a food gifter. So I included lots of big tray dishes as well. There's a kitchen sink salad in there, a big soup, an amaretto tiramisu. That's more amaretto than tiramisu. But, you know, big trays of things that you could bring to parties.
Yeah. Well, actually, one of my favorite is just simply the cheese tray. And that cheese tray itself, I think there's a recipe in the Midwest called like a walking taco where you just take a bag of Frito-Lays and put some chili in it.
Yes.
And it's like the walking cheese tray.
It totally is. And it's so funny that you mentioned the cheese tray because I just came back from an event and I met Molly Yeh, who is amazing. And she sent me an email this morning and said the first thing I did for our big farm harvest party was literally make a traveling cheese tray and brought it out into the middle of the field. So I'm like, what? But it's so easy. It's just some cheese and some things from your larder in a bag. And then you open the bag up and set it all out on the bag. And, you know, it pretty consistently looks gorgeous.
And it's wonderfully labeled, too. You know,
sure.
Often you think you have to bring this big piece of slate or wood, and it has to be this very kind of heavy, and not to say that this isn't elegant, but presented in a specific way, but you know, the efficiency too. I'm a utilitarian.
So am I.
Yeah.
So I want it all to go in the right place, be purposeful, and then be able to use it another way. So in that bag, I actually say, grab a sheet of newspaper, grab a sheet of parchment paper, lay it all out, maybe use some tape, to actually label everything so people know what it is. But it's pretty easy and effortless. And I think there's a lot of recipes in that book, in my book.
That book. Oh, yeah, it is my book.
It's my book. Yeah. In my book that are like that, that are sort of easy things you can do on the go.
Yeah, I mean, aside from the food, the biggest part about this book is being able to gift wrap or, you know, package these things. How important is packaging for you from other people's perspective, other people's brands, and, you know, what do you need to actually make edible gifts sendable?
So there's like two answers to that. For the stuff I sell in my shop, packaging is really important. We are spending money on things that we love, that taste better, that may use better techniques or better ingredients, and we want that stuff to look beautiful when we gift it. In the book, I actually wanted to write a cookbook that included the gift wrap because people seem to struggle when they think about food gifts. They like, it stops them. They're like, I can make the jam, but like, what do I do to gift it to somebody? And I'm like, it's so easy. Let's just make a label together. Let's just make a label and some tape or some twine. So it was really important for me to convey that. And I conveyed that by using a lot of simple, easily accessible items like the New York Times, like newspapers, like food sections of the New York Times, which is how I started, at least my gift wrap larder. It starts differently for other folks. But I actually started collecting the food sections of the New York Times and then twine from the butcher or extra paper, extra tape. And I started wrapping gifts with just those simple items.
So sustainable. I've underlined three times, your trash is treasure.
It really is. It really is. You don't understand how I like look through my pantry and I look through my cabinet and all my closets before I go out and go shopping and buy a gift, because there's so much stuff, you know, hidden away in your shelves or your drawer that you can turn into a gift quite easily.
Well, I mean, you brought me some wonderful gifts, a cranberry vinegar, a balsamic blackberry glaze, and I know I will use these wholeheartedly, yeah. But I'm also like, yes, more bottles. Because in my head, I'm like, I'm going to put something else in those afterwards. And you see how, and I'm like, you know, sheltering my mouth from the microphone, but you can still hear these molasses cookies. Because if
they better make those home.
Yeah, exactly. I could have not mentioned them, and my wife would have been like, "Oh yeah." So you just got that vinegar and that glaze. That's cool. But
sure.
And these, I'm not even going to open them now because I know I will be ravenous for those.
But you're right. The bottles, I loved about how you could sort of take those bottles once you're done using them, clean them all out and re-gift them. And there's a lot of those things in the book. So for me, when I wrap something with ribbon or twine, I actually wrap it with like an extra half a foot of ribbon or twine, just cut 6 or 7 or 8 inches so that people can take it apart and actually reuse it and re-gift it. It makes so much sense to me. And when someone gives something to me, I sort of put it in my drawer or my shelving unit where I have piles and piles of ribbon now that have been gifted to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's talk about these vessels, too, because I think one of the most inspired gifts are these infused salts, because there's a story about Venice behind it. First, tell me about Venice.
Venice was a revelation. So I, part of my family is from Italy, but from down south. And I had been sort of holding off for years because of either money or job or whatever it is going to Italy. And about 5 years ago, I went to Italy with a friend of mine. He at the time was a chef there in Pavia, a little town outside of Milan. And he took me to Venice, and I had just landed that day, and we got on the train and went to Venice. So you can imagine that I was like groggy and bleary-eyed and jet-lagged, and I had no idea what was going on. But he sort of promptly just took my hand, took me off the train, got me on one of those boats and the water taxis, and we were dropped off in one of the markets. And he just said, sit down. That was it. He just said, sit down. And all I could see was this produce all around me. And he ordered two beautiful salads. They had this beautiful sort of combination of fennel, citrus. There were briny, salty olives on it, a little olive oil. And that moment, even though I was bleary and jet lag, I remembered it so much that I wanted to make it into something that I could give to people when I get back without spending a fortune. So I turned it into a sea salt. The moment I got back, I whipped it up into a sea salt and gave souvenirs to folks. So I didn't have to necessarily think about spending money there because I was so crazy.
Or jet-lagged. Transporting it back at the same time, too.
Exactly, transporting it back. So I waited till I got home. I made them when I got home, and my family all got those as gifts. So, yeah, that's one of my favorite little tidbits in the book. You know, you try to write a book that's very helpful and certainly direct, but you wanted to share some of the stories behind some of the gifts too.
See, what I really wanted you to share are those graham cracker toffee things.
Oh my gosh, they're so good.
I mean, not to say that I'm upset about these molasses cookies because they are my favorite one, but I saw those things and you're like, you know, every family has them. I'm like, no, not my family. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Whoa, you've got to be talking to your family because every family has them. And the friend that gave me that and then gave me the recipe, that same day she gave them both to me, she totally changed my gifting because every cookie tray has them now at the holidays, or even just a box of those on their own. They're not really, they're not toffee because they're not necessarily made in the authentic way toffee's made, but with the crackers and the butter and the sugar, they're just with a little chocolate on top. They're heavenly. So everybody wants them. I have to keep making those for people.
See, I think you'd have marshmallow palate fatigue after all that you've tasted, but these jam swirled marshmallows in your book seem to be, you know, pretty epic.
Yeah, they're really pretty and they're really delicious. And for me, when I taste marshmallows, sometimes what's missing for me is a little pop of flavor, like a brightness. You know, it's really mallow, like marshmallow, and soft and spongy and sweet and delicious. But I wanted a bright zing through it. So I use a little bit of jam or reduced jam to zing through the marshmallows right when they're done. And then they firm up and you have these little bits of jam through them. And it was actually one of the more popular recipes with the recipe testers because many of them, especially the more accomplished ones, may know how to make certain types of marshmallows, but they'd never done that before. So that was fun. That was fun.
I'm kind of a hothead, as you can tell from my demeanor right now. But by that, I mean candied jalapenos.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I love them. I there's a story there, too, because I remember watching my mother and her friends and all my Latin family just eat jalapenos by the handful, like not even thinking. I could never do that as a kid. And now I make the candied kind and I put them in sort of smoky or more savory dishes, or I just throw them into tortillas. Now, I didn't understand it as a kid, but as an adult, you know, your palate, your taste change, and I love them. They're so good.
Were you allowed to have rompopo as a child?
No, I don't think so. I'm not quite sure.
So tell me about this is like Aladdin eggnog, and this recipe was derivative of some old vintage cookbook from Honduras.
It was, yeah. It was actually an old cookbook written by the wives of the lawyers of Tegucigalpa in Honduras, and that big tomb was given to my mother and many women when they got married. So my mother started making rompopo, and it's sort of a thing at the holidays now. We can't have a party without having rompopo between October and January. And I remember when I first did the first draft of the cookbook, it wasn't in there. And I showed it to a couple of family members, and they were shocked. And they were mad at me. They were actually mad at me that I didn't put it in there. And I thought, no, I don't know if people will understand this. So I threw it through the recipe testing cycle, and I asked a bunch of recipe testers to taste it, and it was a hit. So we had to add it back in. My mother still makes it this day, but she makes her own batch separate from the rest of us, because she adds a little extra rum into hers. So none of us can really, it's a little much for, the version that's in my cookbook is the one most of us drink. My mother adds a little bit extra.
Yeah, I think I'm going to actually asterisk both those jalapenos and the rompopo and say, you know, be like Maggie's mother. A little bit extra for me.
But I love that.
Congrats again. I mean, this book is fantastic, but even better is, you know, you have this food store with stories that's so transportive, and your willingness to, you know, share other people's wares and now your own is just so infectious. So I want to help other people, you know, take this book and run with it in the way that you have with other people's products.
Thank you. That's very sweet. Thank you.
Run out, buy food, give love. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Thank you to Union Beer Distributors for sponsoring, the band Cookies for the music, as always. And next up, a little clip from Greenhorn Radio. Cheers.
Easy grass. They're very good at eating grass. And they're quite strong poultry. They don't really have the same problems that chickens or other kind of weaker species have. They can be outside in a hurricane and be totally fine. You know, you might lose a few and they might get blown down the river, but they're not going to get chilled and they're not going to have any trouble with kind of small varmints.
Young farmers Wesley Bascom and David Hart recently started grazing geese in Vermont. They talk about all these interesting birds in episode 163 of Greenhorns Radio.
Well, I personally find them to be endlessly fascinating. They are not the, you know, vile, mean creatures of the myth. They are really curious, inquisitive, very bright birds that just, they're really fascinating. They do all sorts of things, and I think it takes a close inspection of them to really appreciate this. They are noisy, that's true, but they talk to each other. It's not just endless noise. It's an actual conversation that's occurring, and they and I find that somewhat amusing, honestly.
Hear more voices of young farmers like Wesley and David on Greenhorns Radio, Tuesdays at 4 p.m., and listen to past episodes on Heritage Radio Network and iTunes.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.